This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, a look at some promising new research using CRISPR gene editing to fix mutations in human embryos. Important stuff. But first, after this past election, there's been a lot of chatter about hacking the voting system. This June, a leaked National Security Agency report described efforts by the Russian military intelligence to launch a cyber attack to interfere with the U.S. elections, targeting voter registration and local election officials. And this weekend, organizers of the DEF CON security conference wanted to test how voting machines could be hacked. The results? It took just 90 minutes for the hackers to get into the machines. So can we secure our voting machines and databases? That's what we'll be talking about. Our number 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Let me introduce my guests. Edward Felton is a professor of computer science and public affairs and director of the Center for Information Technology Policy at Princeton University. Joseph Lorenzo Hall is chief technologist at the Center for Democracy and Technology in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Let me give out our numbers, 844-724-8255 again, or you can tweet us at SciFry. Joe, you were at DEF CON this weekend. Tell us about, give us an example of how these hackers were able to get into these machines so quickly.
Yeah, so the specific example you mentioned that the one machine was hacked into in about 90 minutes, actually, the thing that took so long to do that was that that individual actually had to leave the facility and go buy a USB keyboard and come back. And so when he came back, there were two open USB ports on the back of this machine, which is completely decertified, this AVS WinVote. And he did the three-finger salute, the Windows Control Delete, and then it dropped a task manager. And then he could load whatever he wanted, and they installed Winamp and played the now famous Rick Astley song, the Never Gonna Give You Up song.
Are there any of these machines, the kinds that he hacked, still being used at any election sites?
So some of these machines are still in use, but for the most part, these were purchased on eBay or GovDeals, which is the government version of eBay. And so in many cases, they were 2 or 3 years old, so they're not going to be running the most current software, for example. So we did not have the actual examples of voting machines used today. These are sort of the ones that we can get from a surplus, basically.
Well, if you buy them on eBay, do they still have the software, the voting stuff on it?
Well, they do. And so, for example, that was one of the things that this group of hackers was really interested in. Can you know, to what extent is the software protected? How can you get it off? Can you examine it? In one case, something that wasn't a voting machine, a voter registration device, actually still contained a bunch of voter records that was problematic, and we weren't expecting that.
Ed Felton, you've tested voting machines yourself. You were able to put a virus on a voting machine. Did this surprise you at all?
It did surprise us a little bit at the time. We didn't realize when we first started studying these machines about 12 years ago how vulnerable they would turn out to be. But over the years, Joe and Joe's group and my group and others have done a lot of research on the electronic voting machines. And in every case, we have found troubles and vulnerabilities.
How easy is it to go into a voting booth that has a voting machine? And it's basically a computer, right? The voting machine. And take a thumb drive and stick it into the USB port and do something.
It is a computer. It is a computer, and so and typically all of the usual ways of installing software on computers will work. If you're in a polling place and people are looking at you, they might look at you strangely if you were to stick a USB keyboard into a voting machine or something like that. But there are ways to get access, physical access, hands-on to voting machines in other settings. And in every case we've seen, if you can get your hands on a machine, then you can change what it does. I have a machine in a lounge area outside my office here at Princeton, which some students reprogrammed into a Pac-Man machine.
Wow. So you're saying it's possible, but is it not? It's not practical to do something to the voting machines in reality as they're being used?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. To attack a voting machine on election day in the voting booth would be more difficult because there are eyes on that mm-hmm. room. But voting machines are stored in warehouses every other day of the year, and there are, just like with other computers, there are indirect ways of getting to them by by creating viruses or other sorts of malware that will spread onto the voting machines. And that's probably a bigger threat in practice.
Joe, my smartphone has two-factor authentication on it. Can we put some sort of that encryption on these voting machines?
So many of these machines are 10 to 15 to 20 years old. And so to the extent that we ask of them to do sort of very modern, or at least in the last 2 years, kinds of security operations, like you're saying, a two-factor, for example, that's asking a bit much. And so often what we have to do is sort of, you know, look to other things. So, for example, processes, chain of custody, human types of things that election officials actually spend a lot of time thinking about. But you can imagine there's so much variation that mm-hmm. it just depends on where you are, what the machine is, and how vigilant that particular operation is.
Not much of the software and many of the machines is proprietary to the company that actually makes and distributes the machines, the voting machines. I've been reading online that people are calling for open source software, not proprietary software. Why would that be an advantage yet?
Well, open source software would eliminate one of the barriers to improving this system, and that is that it would allow independent experts or members of the public to look at the software and analyze it for potential vulnerabilities. Very early in the process of studying, in the history of studying these machines, it was difficult to get access to the software, to get hands on the machines, and so on. So that's definitely a step in the right direction, but it's not a solution in itself. That lets you find problems, but doesn't necessarily fix them for you.
Is there a solution in itself?
The best way to address this is to build a system that is resilient, so that even if someone does compromise a voting machine, the overall election process is safe because you detect the problem and then you can recover. And that involves using a voter-verified paper record. That is something that is written on paper that the voter saw, that is kept in a ballot box. So when you have the combination of a paper record and an electronic record, and then you do a good post-election audit to compare the paper and electronic records, that gives you the best and most resilient result. That way you're safe mm-hmm. even if the machines are compromised.
And that's really where the action is, because you know, when I was a postdoc with Ed at Princeton, we developed a form of a statistical recount called a risk-limiting audit that allows you to essentially do what you would have done in a recount without counting as many ballots. And we really need to see both permanent indelible records like paper records and these statistical methods to make sure it's right.
Mm-hmm. But each locality uses its own system for voting. I mean, there may be so many different systems. Is there a standardized system we should come up with?
Well, the NIST definitely keeps standards about systems that systems should meet, but there's so much variation in our population and what people are comfortable with that election officials have sought to get very different machines. I will note that election officials are starting to build their own machines. So in Travis County, Texas, and Los Angeles County, California, they're starting to build tanks of voting machines, just extremely secure, wonderful, cryptographic, glorious, paper record-based, auditable machines.
Let's see if I get a quick call in from Denver, from Rich in Denver. Hi, Rich.
Hey, Ira. How you doing? Great show. Hey, you can solve this problem in 1 minute. And when I first started voting in the 80s, go back to paperless ballots, everybody. It'd be done tomorrow. You know, there's places in this country, you know, where poor and lower educated, especially minority, don't have internet access. They can't vote. They can't get to machines. We could solve this tomorrow by going back to paperless ballots, coast to coast.
All right. What do you think of that, Ed and Joe?
Well, I think paper ballots work, and they're the most disaster-proof in the sense that the system, a paper-based system, will work no matter what happens with the electricity or anything else. But from a security standpoint, there are advantages to having a system that uses a combination of paper and electronic. Having those redundant records, the paper record that the voter filled out or saw, I'm absolutely behind that. But then also, say, an electronic scan of that, and then being able to compare them, that gives you the best level of security. And should the machine break down and not work, you can always fall back to a good old-fashioned paper ballot and ballot box system.
Yeah, and I'll add really quickly that L.A. has 11 languages. You can't put 11 languages on a single ballot and make that usable. And so in terms of usability and accessibility and just ease of the voting process, it's really not a paper ballot or not question.
Is there one kind of voting interface that's worse than the other? For example, is touch screen worse than maybe a mouse or the paper ballot combination?
There's been studies on this, and touchscreens actually perform quite well. It tends to be things like the punch cards, you know, that we don't have a lot of anymore, or there's that one machine that actually uses an iPod-like dial that people think is a touchscreen and start touching it and realize this doesn't work, and then they use the dial, and so those are the ones that tend to be the poorer there.
So is the greater threat from inside the system or outside the system, kind of leaking in?
I think it's both. You need to be prepared against both types of problems. Historically, unfortunately, there are a lot of incidents of voting officials who have or poll workers who have misbehaved. Those problems can exist. They've historically existed. They don't exist so much today. But you also worry about a sort of big high stakes attack coming from outside. And certainly in last fall's election, we were quite concerned about that occurring. Fortunately, that has not occurred yet.
Mm-hmm. It also depends on what you worry about. So if you're worried about the presidential election, that is rather difficult because of the distribution of the different kinds of technology. But for a local election, your proverbial Tony Soprano may consider it worth his while to spend $100,000 to fix an election for a local waste management bond that might be like $5 million. And those have to be just as much in our threat models as anything else.
Mm-hmm. Good stuff to talk about. We will continue this discussion because it's an evolving one. Ed Felton, Professor of Computer Science and Public Affairs, Director of the Center for Information Technology and Policy at Princeton University. Joe Lorenzo Hall, Chief Technologist at the Center for Democracy and Technology in Washington. Thank you both for taking time to be with us.
Thank you. It's really an honor, Ira.
You're welcome.
It's my pleasure. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about this now famous human gene editing step that was taken or is announced this week about editing a human embryo and fixing a genetic defect in the embryo. Why we should be both excited, yes, and cautious about where this new research will take us. Stay with us. Our number 844-724-8255 or tweet us at SciFry. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You may have heard that our old friend CRISPR is back in the headlines again this week. This time, researchers from Oregon Health and Science University use this gene editing technology to fix a genetic mutation in human embryos. Now, this isn't designer babies. We're talking about using CRISPR to swap out a mutated gene inherited from one parent for a healthy gene from the other parent. But the impact of just this small change could be huge. Imagine a day where we could eliminate certain deadly or debilitating diseases from future generations by just swapping out one little piece of a gene. Of course, there are scientific challenges and regulations, and most importantly, ethical concerns to address before we get there. Joining me now is one of the co-authors of the new study. Sukrat Metallopov is director of the Center for Embryonic Cell and Gene Therapy at Oregon Health and Science University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What did you and your colleagues set out to do in this study? Is this basically a proof of concept idea?
Yes. So the one of the main goals of our center is to develop and study technologies that would allow us to basically replace mutant genes in the early embryos or even in gametes. It's called germline because humans actually carry many of these kind of germline mutations that mean passed from parents. We have about 10,000 or so mutant genes that causing a variety of diseases. And the idea was we can allow some of the parents to have children without, worrying to pass this mutation. In this particular case, this was one of the types of mutations that cause disease even if there is only one copy of the mutant gene transmitted. As you know, we have in most of our genes, we have two copies. One comes from mom, one from dad. And there are some mutations when you have to have both copies mutated, then there would be no normal protein made. But this case that we've been working on, this is actually one mutant copy is enough to cause disease.
Mm-hmm. And what I find, this was a heart disease, and what I find interesting about this, a lot of different things, but in particular, you tried a couple of different ways. And first, you tried delivering CRISPR and the external replacement gene together into a fertilized embryo, and then got a different result with a non-fertilized embryo.
The idea of using CRISPR or some other gene editing tools is that they mainly give you just access to gene, and they induce actually damage, the cut. The good thing is you could program and tell this CRISPR which gene you're targeting and where to make a cut. But that's all they do. But we need to fix the mutation, not just to make a damage additional to this gene. And that's when the cell's own SOS or repair mechanism come in place. Every cell has this, DNA repair mechanism. They always, survey integrity, and once they find that there is a breakage there, they immediately start basically gluing it together. So we sometimes provide a a small synthetic gene, which we call external template, that we hope they'll be used to repair this gene and hopefully remove mutation as well. And that, when we provided this to embryos and saying this is a normal gene and we would like you to use this when you repair this breakage, embryos actually refused to use this synthetic gene. But the good thing is, as I mentioned, this mutation was heterozygous, meaning the only one of the parents would provide this mutant gene, whether a second parent, in this case, maternal side, would be normal. So the embryos always chose that maternal normal gene as a blueprint to repair the damaged paternal gene. So this was quite different and unexpected. We actually tried to use this CRISPR with patient skin cells and some other cell types, which we consider as a somatic, basically body cells. And the body cells, they actually respond a little bit differently, and the DNA repair system appears to be quite different. But the embryos, they actually like to do this job very well. It's been known that because of the germline, which is very important for survival of species, and maintaining integrity of DNA is quite different than more stringent in the germline.
Does this mean that you don't need to provide the external repair gene for this to work?
So at least with this study, it didn't make any difference. So embryos would always refuse it. Hmm. But the good thing is, as I said, we had another normal gene that seems like will take over. But we've been now thinking, as I mentioned, there are mutations or gene mutations that have to be in two copies. And there are diseases like that, say cystic fibrosis. When both parents would pass this mutant gene, that would be both of them would be the same and mutant. So if we instruct to cut and repair both genes, then what the copy will be served as a template, and then we would have to provide a third synthetic gene. But we have to now figure out a way how to embryos to use this template to repair this both now copies.
So you haven't gotten that far yet.
No, we're still working. So this is actually the next project we're working on, and we're looking at so-called homozygous mutations and find a way now to repair, or at least help the embryos self-repair and give them right instructions to do it.
Does this suggest that adding external genes to the embryos is going to be tougher than you expected?
Yeah, at this point, seems like you'd have to do something differently if you want to insert some extra piece of DNA, and the embryo seems like refuse it.
I want to bring on another point of view about this, because news of this research has sparked many reactions from stakeholders, including the American Society of Human Genetics, which published a policy statement on human germline genome editing this week. I want to bring on one of the authors of that report, Kelly Ormond, professor of genetics at Stanford School of Medicine and faculty at the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks so much for having me, Ira.
Do you have any fear about the results of this experiment?
You know, it's a really exciting study and scientific development, and we actually started writing our position paper 2 years ago, I think with the fear that we need to be cautious about how this research moves forward, and all of the press about designer babies really exemplifies that. That makes people quite nervous, and we also don't know what the medical and scientific risks and benefits of these sorts of procedures are. So I think the main point of our statement was that basic science research like this at quite early stages is appropriate if it's done in a regulated manner with good oversight and transparency, but we shouldn't be leaping from this straight to having it implanted into a woman's uterus and seeing those babies born.
That's still illegal, is it not?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And no one is talking about taking that step yet, but we're just talking about to see if it might work in these early experiments.
Yeah, and I think the main issue is that not every country in the world has the same sorts of regulations or the same ability to enforce regulations. And so we really felt quite strongly with our statement, which was signed by 11 international organizations across 5 continents, that we need to get everybody around the globe talking about this so that it happens in parallel with the science that's going on. So that in 5 years, we're not all of a sudden surprised by what's happening and caught off guard with no policies.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Metallopov, do you basically agree with this line of reasoning?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we actually going through review on this paper in Nature, and several reviewers actually brought up this issue saying, well, of course, this is basic study. None of these embryos we intended, and we not, even thinking that we have a way of going to transfer these embryos. But how are you going to control this kind of unregulated IVF clinics that may just use it? The example is in parallel, we've been working on this mitochondrial gene replacement, also in the idea of replacing mutant mitochondria, which works a little bit different. Unfortunately, CRISPR doesn't work there. But studies and technologies were progressing really well in the academic institutions and in labs. But all suddenly, private clinics took it, and the children already born in very poor regulated studies or clinical trials that actually doesn't seem like these private clinics actually equipped to do clinical trials, and that was the concern. And I think having many of the societies, scientific, expressing their view that, yes, basic science and in vitro studies must go on, but it's too early to move to clinical applications.
Mm-hmm. I have a tweet coming in from James. It says, how do you know when you're cutting the gene that you're not removing something helpful by accident?
That's a good question, as we mentioned, the CRISPR may recognize some slightly similar sequences around the genome, and we have a pretty large genome. The only way to know it is to do very thorough screen on every embryo or biopsied cell from the embryo, and look for these potential so-called off-target mutations. Mm-hmm. So far, we didn't detect anything wrong, and it looks like this particular CRISPR construct was very faithful. But you're going to say that this will be for every other target gene, because the CRISPR will be designed a little bit differently, and I guess this off-target has to be screened, and it has to be part of the PGD before we say that this is, there is no harmful unintended mutations.
Dr. Oman, you were talking about the ethical problems of using this technique, but what about the flip side of this, the ethical problems of not using this technique, which might save thousands of lives of people who come down with a genetic disease?
Absolutely. Everybody wants to see individuals and families who are faced with genetic disease get treatments or cures, and no one who's experiencing those is going to say, gosh, I think we shouldn't be considering this at all. But I do want to be really clear, there are also many other options for doing it. And one is to use this in a somatic way, on the affected cells in an individual's body, so you're not changing an embryo or changing that person's germline and what they would pass on to future generations. So those future generations would still have to be dealing with it. But you can also think about the currently available techniques of prenatal diagnosis and genetic testing, as well as IVF and PGD. So when we're really thinking about people who would use this down the line, it probably is going to be pretty rare situations and the times when you wouldn't otherwise be able to have a biologically related child using one of those other techniques. Or, as Dr. Metalipov's group has said in their paper, people who feel uncomfortable with doing PGD and discarding embryos after that testing is performed. So those are the potential times when it might actually be useful, and that's going to be a small number of cases.
Mm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about this new CRISPR headline this week about fixing a genetic defect in human embryos, which we should repeat, these embryos were never brought to term, were never implanted. They were just done in a dish. Correct, Dr.?
Yes. So we recover gametes and sperm and egg and all the fertilization done in petri dish, and we have a small window about 4 or 5 days when these embryos can develop. It's still a small, group of cells, hardly visible on the microscope. And there was, of course, never intention of using these embryos to transfer and establishing pregnancy. This was very strictly said in consent forms to donors who donated the gametes, but also our IRB regulations locally, they only allow us to do this in vitro work. Going further, for example, sometimes in the future, and if transplanting embryos back into a patient, where federal regulatory agencies would regulate it. Unfortunately, at this point, we still don't have any way of going forward, just because the FDA, who is supposed to be regulating, actually they stepped forward many years ago saying this is gene therapy, even in the germline, and we would like to regulate it as gene therapy. But unfortunately, most recent restrictions to funding from a Congress to FDA wouldn't allow them even to review and work on INDs. So this is where we're kind of still unclear, mm-hmm. Because there is no clear ban on transplanting, but it seems like the FDA is not allowed to regulate. So this is a kind of very strange situation that needs to be probably resolved.
But Dr. Ormondig, as you pointed out, it doesn't prevent other countries where these bans may not be.
Yeah, that's correct. Other countries can certainly take this up. And in England, there's a group called HEFA, which looks at this kind of research. But right now, it's really a funding issue in the United States. And our statement actually did go so far as to recommend reconsideration of that ban on funding around embryo research. We said that because we think that federal research actually undergoes a different level of oversight and regulation, and it's more transparent. And for something as controversial as this, if it's going to be happening in the United States, we really would encourage our Senate and our House to consider this and the potential importance.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Metalipov, are you going to be moving forward with the next step on this?
I think we still have a lot more to look in the basic science. As I mentioned, there are so many different mutations. So we have our work cut out, of course, to do in vitro work without ever transplanting these embryos, particularly improving efficiency. So this repair does occur with I would say majority of the embryos, but not all. And for germline, this may not be efficiency may not be high enough, and so we still have way to improve it. But of course, the intention is of these doing research in human embryos is it has to be for sake of future treatments and. Would be happy to move forward and work with FDA, particularly because defining what's the next step and the safety efficacy studies that needs to be done. It usually it's FDA usually regulates it, and at this point, since they're not in the play, so we really wouldn't know mm-hmm. how to move forward.
All right, we'll be watching closely both the FDA, the USA, and other parts of the world. I want to thank Dr. Sukrat Metallapov, Director of the Center for Embryonic Cell and Gene Therapy at Oregon Health and Science University. Kelly Ormond, Professor of Genetics at Stanford School of Medicine, faculty at the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
After
the break, we're going to talk about the ghost particle, the neutrino, and how scientists made the first observation of it actually smashing into an atom. They've been looking for this for decades. We'll talk about it after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Consider the neutrino. Do you know what they are? They're ghostly particles that millions of them rain down on us every second from space, but you can't feel them or see them. And they're pretty hard to detect, too. Scientists have built huge detectors encased in Antarctic ice. They have buried sensors miles down in abandoned mines to try and get a glimpse of these particles. But they've never caught them in the act of collision until now. A team of scientists using a small detector, a tiny little thing at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee, to measure a neutrino smashing into a nucleus for the first time. This week, the results were published in the journal Science, and my next guest is an author on that research. Kate Schulberg is a professor of physics at Duke University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Now, we know this idea of a neutrino hitting the nucleus of an atom was predicted 43 years ago. Why is it taking so long?
Well, it's an interaction that actually it has surprisingly a really high probability of interaction with the nucleus. At low energy, neutrinos have long wavelengths, so it's kind of like light having a long wavelength, and they see the nucleus like a big blob and actually have a very high probability of interacting compared to most neutrino interactions. Neutrino interactions are famously rare. Neutrinos are famously just slide right through things. But in this case, at low energy, it's actually pretty large probability of interacting. But the reason it's been so hard to see is that it's kind of like throwing ping pong balls at a bowling ball. It's really easy to hit the bowling ball, but it's hard to make the bowling ball go very fast. And the tiny little recoil, the little tiny energy that the nucleus gets is really hard to see in a detector. And now we have detector technology that's actually been developed for looking for dark matter. That's another elusive kind of particle, if it exists at all. And these detectors are specifically designed to look for these little tiny bumps that atomic nuclei get when the neutrinos hit them.
So your detector is like a desktop device. It's like a maker thing that people...
It's only barely bigger than a bread box. It's really by neutrino detector standards. I work on other neutrino detectors that are thousands of tons, literally, and this is a really tiny one by neutrino standards.
And you had a brilliant idea, if I might summarize and tell me where I'm wrong here. Your idea was why not go to where we make neutrinos in abundance here on Earth instead of waiting for them to come out from space and put your tiny little detector up close where they're being made on the cheap and detect them coming out?
Yeah, that's exactly right. This is at a facility called the Spallation Neutron Source, which was actually built for an entirely different purpose. It was built to actually create neutrons to do all kinds of different science, material science and biology and all kinds of things. But as a byproduct, actually just for free, it also is probably the world's most beautiful neutrino source in this energy range. It actually is it's a gorgeous source of neutrinos. It makes neutrinos when protons smash into this huge Mercury target. They make particles that decay into neutrinos with a really well-understood spectrum of energies. And so it's extremely clean, and the neutrinos come in these really sharp bursts so that you know exactly when the neutrinos are coming, which is a great advantage when you're trying to do an experiment for very rare interactions. And it's really just been it's kind of a sweet spot. We've really found the perfect source, and we have the great detectors to see them.
So what was the aha moment in someone saying, maybe we do it this way with this detector?
Oh, gosh. Well, there have been a lot of people involved. I think the first ideas to use the neutrinos from this particular source was some of my colleagues a couple of decades ago, at least. To actually use it for coherent scattering, this kind of source was proposed, I think, in the early 80s, in fact. But I think nobody had thought about the spallation neutron source until about 12 years ago. When I was actually at a conference and somebody gave a talk and said, hey, this interaction has never been observed. And I thought, really? That was really surprising to me. Nobody'd seen this really relatively common interaction. And then I realized that the neutrino detector, the WIMP detector technology was now good enough that you could actually see the little kick that the nuclei get when the neutrinos hit them.
Wow. When there's an idea that's a 43-year-old unproven mystery, are scientists compelled to tackle it? I mean, did you all do a sort of a victory dance in the lab?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Victory dance is certainly it. Yeah, it's been really exciting. It's kind of the beginning of a whole set of new experiments that are now on the horizon.
Well, why do we need, it's a ghost particle. It doesn't do much with us. Why? Where does it fit it? Why is it important to know about it?
Oh, there are so many aspects. I'll just name some of them. Well, one thing is that neutrinos are fundamental particles. And so if we want to understand the fundamental physics of nature, if we want to understand what the basic particles are and how they interact, we have to understand neutrinos because they are some of the fundamental particles along with protons and electrons and so on, quarks and electrons and so on. So just understanding the basic properties of neutrinos is part of understanding nature. And I'm a particle physicist, and so I care about that a lot. So that's one reason, and in fact, what this kind of experiment can do is actually set constraints on the standard model of particle physics, which is kind of the framework that particle physicists work with, and that in fact, for actually quite a long time now, there haven't been a lot of chinks in the basic framework. I think we'd all love to see something that's beyond the standard model. So that's certainly one thing. Another thing is that neutrinos are involved in astrophysical processes, and if you're interested in how stars live their lives, how they're born, how they die, neutrinos are deeply involved in those processes, and you have to understand the properties of neutrinos if you want to understand those events, and in effect, if you want to detect them, too.
Wow, you sound like you have a long-term love affair with neutrinos.
Oh, yeah, I love neutrinos. That's certainly true.
Why? I mean, why pick neutrinos of all the subatomic particles?
Well, I love them all, of course. But neutrinos are, they're elusive. They are, they're involved. They touch so many corners of the universe that it's, they're just really appealing.
Do they deserve the name the ghost particle?
Oh, I think so. I mean, there are, they do just zip right through everything and very, very few of them ever interact. The chance of a neutrino from the atmosphere of the sun interacting in your body over your whole lifetime is maybe 50%. So it's very rare, but there's just literally hundreds of trillions of them going through you all the time. So it's, they're really exotic, but they're real, and we can see them in our detectors.
Well, I know you. I'm talking to you from Fermilab, which must love neutrinos.
That's right.
Along with you. Yeah. Well, good luck, and please we'll check back in with you when you get some more results.
Sure.
And congratulations to you and your whole staff and your colleagues for this discovery.
Oh, thank you very much.
Kate,
it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, you're welcome. Kate Cholberg, professor of physics at Duke University. Back in 2013, Dr. Nico Dosenbach had a problem. He wanted to study the brain activity of individual people, but, as a junior-level researcher, he couldn't afford the hourly rate to use the scanning machine he needed, not during normal business hours anyway. That's when the Midnight Scan Club was born, a group of curious researchers who were willing to scan their own brains late at night at midnight, starting with Dr. Dosenbach himself. Here to tell us what he gained in exchange for all those hours of sleep lost is Dr. Nico Dosenbach, Assistant Professor of Neurology at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
You're welcome. Tell us what inspired you to study individual brain activity.
I've been obsessed with that for quite a long time, but the moment I really thought that we could do this was when I heard about work by Stanford professor Russ Poldrack, who'd done something similar on himself. The problem we had was that Russ Poldrek at the time was the director of neurosciences at UT Austin, had a lot of resources. And I had about $10,000. And so at first I didn't know what we could possibly do to scan ourselves enough to have a really clear picture of what an individual's brain looks like. And the sort of eureka moment was when I was talking to my good friend Steve Nelson, longtime friend and collaborator, co-last author on this paper we have, when he told me, we were walking to his car, he was going to give me a ride, when he told me that, hey, Nico, you know, after midnight, scan charges are 90% off. And in my memory, I slapped him on his back really hard, and I said, that's it. That's how we're going to do it. And I'm pretty stubborn. He probably thought I was just kidding at the time, but that's how we all got started.
So you then formed the Midnight Scan Club.
Yeah. The first thing we needed... I didn't have money to pay for primetime scan charges, and I didn't have people I could pay. And so we had to recruit some other folks who were going to work with us in the middle of the night for free, which isn't super easy. So we recruited some super bright grad students, Tim Lauman and Adrian Gilmore, to essentially, because you need two people to do this. You need somebody who's the participant in the middle of the night and somebody who's willing to work the scanner in the middle of the night. And then we got two more people on board later, Jeff Burke and Deanna Green. And so we had our core team of grad students and junior faculty who was all doing this sort of in off hours. And the amount of scanning at night that we wanted to do sounded pretty gruesome. And I decided the best way to find out if somebody can do it is if I would try it. And I was, to be honest, kind of apprehensive in the beginning, but I tried it and it wasn't that bad. And by the time we'd done two data sets, I was the first one, Steve Nelson was the second one. A lot of curious grad students at WashU had heard about it, and we essentially started getting requests. It's like, hey, can I be in the study? I want to know what my brain looks like. And so to get to 10 people willing to do this wasn't all that hard.
Wow. So how many hours did you spend scanning your brain?
The first data set that we just released, it was 12 two-hour scans, so about 24, 25 hours per person. I've done a lot more since then, but that was the original study.
Now, I know that an MRI is a little donut hole in which you put your head into. 2 hours inside of that in the middle of the night.
Yeah, it wasn't easy. The two main problems are people moving too much. And I'm talking about if you move more than 0.2 millimeters, it can hurt the study. So not moving at all. And falling asleep. That's the most difficult one, because one of the scans we did was what's called a resting state scan. You can kind of think of it as meditating with your eyes open, you lie in complete darkness, you got this little white dot on the screen that you're allowed to look at, and you're not allowed to move, and you're not allowed to fall asleep. And we started each, because that's the hardest part of these kind of studies, we started each scan off with 30 minutes of that. And before we had started, most people who heard about this idea were like, "You, Nico, you're fidgety. I've seen you take naps in your office in the afternoon. You cannot do this," which motivated me more. And one of the adaptations I used was to just shift my hours and take a nap sort of from, you know, 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. and then get up and be ready for the scanning in the middle of the night.
Wow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flato talking with Nico Dosenbach, founder of the Midnight Scan Club. Have you amassed enough data, enough scans to reach a conclusion about brain activity of some sort?
Well, I'm really data greedy, so it's never enough. But with the amount of data we have, we've had some really interesting discoveries. The one we kind of thought we were going to find was that previously most functional MRI research has been done on group average data, because it's a very noisy signal. So you usually would get 20, 50, 100, 1,000 people. You take their brain scans, you average all the images together, and then you can say something with clarity about a group of people, like typical people or people with a certain neuropsychiatric disease. And so we thought that wasn't a real image of real brains as they are in the world. There's no such thing as a group average brain. There's no average of your brain and my brain. There's my brain and there's your brain. And we wanted to study the real thing because we thought it would look quite different. And our study definitely shows that it does. An individual map looks nothing like the group map. And the thing we kind of suspected and also found was that not one person's brain, even though we're all night owl neuroscientists in this cohort, you know, who like to stay up late and volunteered for this, they're all different, which kind of makes sense because, you know, even identical twins have different personalities. There's not one other Nico Dosenbach in this world, but it was really fascinating to actually see that. For example, Steve Nelson, my collaborator on this. We're the same age. We have a similar job. We have a similar interest in neuroscience, and his brain looks nothing like mine. Hmm. So that was really fun to see. And the biggest surprise was probably that we might have discovered what I would call common variants in global brain organization. So for the basic backbone of the brain, 8 of the people looked like the group data, kind of, and similar to each other, that the major brain networks related to things like attention, executive control, vision, movement, they were all arranged in sort of a big circle so that information could flow quickly from one end of the giant network. Your brain's essentially a giant network. Information could flow quickly. And we had 2 people where the ring was broken, and we could even prove this mathematically. There's a mathematical property called global efficiency. And in 2 people, that was lower. I'm one of those 2 people. Mm-hmm. I obviously don't think it means that my brain is slow. But it's fascinating to see that there's that much variation across people that are otherwise pretty homogeneous. And the only way to see this is with
right.
high-density MRI scans.
Well, considering there must be hundreds of MRIs sitting idle at midnight across the country, could you invite and crowdsource this to other people?
Oh, that is a great idea. I would love that. Yeah, it's kind of frustrating because MRI is a shared resource at every university. WashU here has a whole bunch. But it's still hard to get on it during primetime hours. So the only way we could standardize our study was to do it at midnight. And you're absolutely right. I mean, it's essentially this very expensive resource is going to waste.
Well,
I'll have to write that down. Thank you.
Well, you know, there might be a few medical people listening to this show and might want to join the Midnight Scan Club in their own scanner. So is it okay if they reach out to you, Nico?
Oh, absolutely. I would love that.
How do they reach you?
We've got a... they could come to my lab website.
What is that?
DosenbachLab.wustl.edu. We've got a Twitter account. I just learned about Twitter. I'm brand new. It's @club_scan.
Say it again?
It's club_scan.
Okay, club_scan. If you want to become part of the Midnight Scan Club, good luck to you and your colleagues and all your members, Nico.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Nico Dosenbach, Assistant Professor of Neurology at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. Finally, to all our fans in Kansas, we'll be live in Wichita on Saturday, September 9th at the Orpheum Theater, talking about ancient bones, dung beetles, sea monsters. You don't want to miss this. Come on down. We'll be there. Tickets are going fast. Find out more at sciencefriday.com/Wichita. That's sciencefriday.com/Wichita. We'll see you Saturday, September 9th at the Orpheum Theater. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.